Where are you coming from, man?
Me, I'm in Baltimore this time. I'm not by the poolside this time. That was last time. Yeah, I'm in Baltimore City, man.
And refresh me, that's where you live?
That's where I live. Born and raised in Charleston. Last time I was at the in-laws in Delray Beach.
Delray Beach.
That's right. That's right. Right. Cool. Well, I'm ready if you guys are.
You guys ready to do this thing?
Let's go. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens.
On the heels of what must have been an exciting few weeks for our man Jamal Lemon, it is so nice to catch back up. Best known for his work as a Good Beer Hunting contributor, a jack of many trades, a man that we met about a year ago through Clubhouse. Welcome back to the podcast, my friend.
Hey, man. Thank y'all. Glad to be back. Old friends, right?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, so a lot's changed. First and foremost, you're not in a dark poolside right now coming at us. And also, you know, a few many thousand words that have resonated and really been celebrated have been written by you since. And you got a fucking James Beard nomination. I mean, that's crazy stuff, man. Congratulations,
dude. Thank you, man. It's quite frightening. It was quite frightening. I'm a lot comfortable now with that news than I was when I first got it. But.
So just to start there, what has that process been like? Because I think about it for myself, like, I've experienced the smallest level of fame pretty much you possibly could within a small area. And I'm well aware of how, in relatively speaking, how tiny that is. But I felt the same thing, like, fuck this. Felt very unnatural to me. Still does, I suppose. But how have you kind of acclimated to that?
Well, with the help of my wife, actually, because like I'm not a shy guy so much. Like I'm not a really good people person, but it's like I'm a diehard team fella, and I want to be Scottie Pippen. I'm not so much concerned about being Jordan. Like I want to be Scottie, and so as far as like when I first got the information through Twitter, like I was like, oh my god, like I was not. Like upset that I was nominated, but I began thinking about just how am I going to make sense of this stuff? Like I didn't even text my wife at the time. Like I just screenshotted it, sent it to Michael Kaiser, and of course he was freaking out. And then as the day went along, you know, more people started to, you know, tweet, send me messages, and which kind of raised the anxiety a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Went out for a walk. Took some deep breaths, told my wife, she freaked out, told her why I was a little like, ugh. And then she just put it really, you know, straightforward. She was like, you know, well, Jamal, you did something that I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good that you're getting recognized for it. Like, you know, you guys put in a lot of work. Myself, Dr. Brian Alberts, Mike Stein, and Peter Carr Jones, like, we have been working on that piece from August of 2020 and up until about June 2021. And then the pieces, part one gets released in July of 2021. So she's like, you know, you need to allow people to give you and your guys praise for the work that you did. You know, that's part of being humble. Like you have to accept that. So, you know, that kind of helped me get a lot more comfortable with it.
It's incredible.
And just refresh me a little bit on how writing became part of your life. Because certainly for me, I became aware of you for Mutated Anxieties. And it's almost kind of funny looking on the GBH website. Because if I remember right, it's just those mostly like for long form pieces, it's just these two main pieces. But they're both these sweeping, hyper in depth, just far from the norm, you know. So it's not something you see all the time, you know. So how did that come into your life?
Well, I've always been an okay writer, like, you know, elementary, middle, high school, or whatever. And I have a master's degree in English. But after graduation, like, I never really did anything. Like, I worked as a school teacher and worked for the federal government. And then, like, the blog era was that, like, late 2000s, like, early 2010s and all of that. I started doing that. So that kind of, like, opened that door up a little bit. Got into the beer industry from the World of Beer thing. We know we don't have to go to again, right? But like after that, I just started, after the World of Beer experience, I just started looking at different platforms related to beer because I was so fascinated with it. And I find Good Beer Hunting, and immediately, like, the pictures are perfect. And then, like, it was all these, as you said, no, like, these very in-depth, long-form writings. And I'm like, damn, like, I didn't even think that deep. I just thought about drinking the beer. And because, and now I would only see beer reviews prior to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, GBH was doing some, like, wild stuff, like, really going left and, I mean, just going everywhere. And all these different voices all over the world, like, speaking about it. So I was like, yo, this is dope. I don't think I'm that good to do, you know, to kind of like do that stuff. So I was just a fan, you know. And then one day, as my dad would say, get, you know, I got some balls about myself. And I sent an email to GBH basically soliciting whatever services I could offer up. Like, you know, I'm Jamal. Actually, Michael Kaiser screenshotted it and sent it on Twitter. And he was like, just a reminder, always shoot your shot. And this is like right after the James Beard stuff. But I was basically asking, you know, I'm Jamal. Like, I would love to contribute in any way possible and blah, blah, blah. And so that started with Michael Kaiser reaching back out. We had a phone call. And we he basically just said, well, you know, let's write something and let's just go from there. So that's kind of like where I am now. That I look at that as that's the start. Kind of, it was all like a practice. So I was doing B-rolls, which, as you know, are like these basically like journal entries from like a picture. It's like this very like in and out kind of perspective about whatever picture that you took. So I did a couple of those and kind of just, you know, not a whole lot. I literally did two. And this was like 2018 and kind of just chilled. And GBH has a Slack channel. And all the contributors and graphic artists and photographers are on there, and they're always talking. And I, you know, I would hop in from time to time, but it seemed like everybody knew each other already, and like nobody. So I didn't really say anything. And even Kaiser kind of like sent me a text one day. He was like, "Yo, do you still have access to the Slack?" I was like, "Yeah, I do, man." It's like I just, you know, I don't think I mean, I'm just trying to find my way in. You know, I'm not the loud guy, so. And then I did like a couple more B-rolls, and then boom, pandemic hits, boom, George Floyd, mutated anxieties, and everything is kind of like just been like rolling since then.
That's amazing, man. I do apologize about forgetting about the B-rolls. I looked at those extensively for our first interview. It's just been a minute.
But I think that's... kind of perfect time to take it to the piece that got you nominated for the award and kind of really dive in to what is a massive piece of writing, incredibly well researched, and just kind of, we'll give a little summary of what it was to us and kind of break down from there everything about the piece because it's truly incredible. We'll start with the name. It's Take Care of the Root. Can you talk about the name, what that means, and where that comes from?
So, yeah. So I'm from Charleston, South Carolina, and Charleston has at one point, I don't know the percentage, but let's just say a very high percentage of West Africans were brought into the U.S. through the port of Charleston. If you know anything about Charleston, it's a coastal city. And those West Africans were brought to the New World to be enslaved to work the land. They were brought over to grow and pick cotton, mainly specifically in Charleston, was to harvest rice. Rice was like gold during this time. And if you look at the geography of West Africa, certain parts of West Africa and Charleston, and the climate is very similar. right?
Mm.
Those West Africans that were brought there, they were able to hold on to a lot of their traditions, like the way they lived, some of the dialect, which then got influenced, or a lot of English words found their way into the dialect, most importantly, the cuisine. So the dialect, those people in Charleston are called Gullah Geechee folk, right? They're African-Americans that live on the Sea Islands of Charleston, in the city of Charleston. And they, again, like they were able to hold on to a lot of West African traditions, cuisine, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. One of which is the dialect. And so this part of South Carolina, Charleston, the Lowcountry, what they call it, which is from Kingston, North Carolina, down the coast, all the way to like Jacksonville, Florida. This is all considered like the Gullah Geechee Corridor. The dialect is not like your typical perceived stereotypical Southern twang type dialect. It sounds very similar to Caribbean accent. My wife is Guyanese, which is a Caribbean country in South America. And a lot of the food and a lot of the things that her and her parents say and her family say is very, very similar to the things that I heard growing up. So Take Care of the Root is just that. It's a Gullah Geechee saying, you know, mostly from like the old folks, which basically means is if you know anything about planting trees or plants, you know, if you see the leaves on your plants dying, like you don't water the leaf. You don't tend to the leaf. You have to then, you know, repot, resoil, address those roots, address the root cause. And then that's going to prolong the life of that plant. So that's saying take care of the root. The full phrase is take care of the root for heal the tree. And that's exactly what that is. And it kind of, I don't want to say I flipped it, but like it pertains to this story because, you know, I don't know if I'm going too far or rambling, but
no.
Like personally, my life, like I've always been in the middle of a lot of different people. Like, you know, I grew up in South Carolina, Gullah Geechee, like obviously I had like tons and tons and tons of black friends. I was an athlete. I had tons and tons and tons of white friends. And even those were kind of like, and I don't want to like sound like an elitist, but like my black friends that were like in the street and doing what they did, I had a connection with them. Like we were cool.
Mm-hmm.
The middle class, whatever, black folks, cool with them. My white homeboys, my Asian homeboys, homegirls, like, I hope this doesn't sound derogatory, but like my redneck homeboys that play football, like I was cool with them. Like I'd stay over their house. Their mom would cook for me. And then my preppy white boys. So like I had a connection with everybody. Like, you know, I was pretty, you know, fairly popular.
In the first pod, you quoted some Earl Sweatshirt.
Earl Sweatshirt, yeah.
A little too black for the white kids, a little too white for the black kids.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, I'm going to do some things that may culturally not apply to my black folks. Going to breweries all the time. I mean, you look at me now, like I'm dressed in offshore fishing attire. I mean, I'm not even going fishing today, but this is like what I like to wear, you know what I'm saying? And like for, you know, some of my white folks, my white homies and all of that, like, you know, like I'm cool, but like, I don't want to say don't kid it. Yeah, but like, I'm still who I am. Like, I know who I am and I know disparities in the world that are going on. So don't think that I will not talk about those issues.
Mm.
But because they're all my friends, they kind of understand who I am. And I think that they're, you know, more receptive to things like that. Me like, nah, man, come check out this brewery. Trust me, it's cool. Or like my white homeboy's like, nah, man, that may not necessarily be, you know, true. Like, yes, black folks have a different connection with law enforcement. Here's why. Like, so this piece was like nobody is predetermined to like or dislike anything. And like, it's not cool to say, oh, breweries is just some white boy shit, or black folks don't, you know, just don't like beer. I know about those. I get those, you know, I get that all the time, a lot, especially from like my black friends. Oh, that's some white boy shit. Well, it's like, let me address why I think both sides may think this way. And just like, it would just, and I hate to always be, you know, connect everything to race, but you know, there's a lot of talk about race and, you know, I just try to look at it from every side. Like, if I'm a white guy and I'm hearing people say, oh, you know, it's just too many white guys with beards, like blah, blah, blah. Even if I'm the cool white guy, at some point you have to feel like, God damn, man, like I'm not even doing anything. Like I keep hearing that and that, like I feel like people are talking to me. So I just try to look at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. With so much going on, it's hard to sift through a lot of information. Mm-hmm. So I'm in the beer industry. That's pretty much all I do outside of talking about college football. So let's just break this thing down. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. Let's break that down. So it's like trying not to have too many variables in the conversation. Like make it very, very, very specific.
Yeah.
Zero black-owned breweries in Charleston. There are zero black-owned breweries in the state of South Carolina. Why? Does that mean that black folks just don't like beer? I don't think so. Here's proof why. This story that we found about this German gun and beer festival that had a heavy African-American Gullah Geechee influence during this gun and beer festival. It's kind of, you see what I'm saying? It's the fingerprint to African-American exclusion as it relates to beer.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah.
And that's in the article, you kind of pose that very well with a trip home. Mm-hmm. And you're with a friend bouncing around some different breweries. And then that question gets asked, where are all the black people? Mm-hmm. And then from there, you kind of draw a line, kind of the through line to today through the fest that you mentioned, the Schutzen Fest. Mm-hmm. Correct. And the historical way that that kind of came about evolved over time, and using that as an example to get to what is kind of a ridiculous stat that you just put out, that in all of Charleston, and I believe the entire state of South Carolina, there is not one black owned brewery. Mm-hmm. So let's start with some of the fest, and what was it about? I guess, how did this fest even get on your radar as like an important historical event that has through lines to today?
So I got pulled into this project fairly late on the tail end. So as I mentioned, Dr. Brian Alberts, Peter Carr Jones, Mike Stein, they were already in talks about this Schutzen Fest that was going on in Charleston. Mike Stein, I knew Mike Stein from 2016. He moderated a panel that I was on shortly after the World of Beer stuff. And he also worked at a DC brewery that was down the street from a DC brewery where I worked. I worked at Atlas. He worked at DC Brow. Dr. Brian Alberts, I knew him because I moderated a panel that he was on 3 years after Mike had me on his panel. In D.C. at the Heirich House. So the only person I really didn't know was Peter Jones. But Peter Jones and Mike Stein worked together. They run a beer research firm in D.C. called Lost Lagers. So anyway, they're in talks with this project. Mike Stein hits me up and is like, yo, what's going on? Hey, Mike, what's up, man? I haven't talked to you in a while. And he's like, hey, man, we've been working on this project. It's about this festival that happened in Charleston during Reconstruction, so right after the Civil War. And myself and the rest of the guys, like, we really want to bring you in on this. And I'm like, oh, okay, check it out. For one, I had never heard of this. I think I mentioned this on the last podcast. My mom is a retired history teacher, so I know a fair amount of South Carolina history. I'd never heard this before. And so I was like, yeah, man, let's get on the call. So get on the call, and they're talking about this festival. And, you know, Brian Alberts is like, I'm convinced, man. Like, he just – you know how people are, like, born to play sports, born to play – he's born to know history. Like, so he's just rattling stuff off, and, you know, they're kind of playing off of him. And at the end, they're like, okay, so, yeah, we want you to be a part of this thing. And I'm like, whoa. You guys are bona fide historians. I'm just a guy that randomly writes stuff from time to time. Like, why? I don't get, why do you need me? And I have to, you know, give them a lot of love and respect for this, because, and not, I don't think this was, had they not included me, I don't think that would have been an example of appropriation. But I think because they are aware of how messages can kind of like get crossed, they were like, well, we could tell this story, but this story involves a very significant African-American involvement in this festival. And you're in the beer industry and you're from Charleston. We just think it would be good for you to be involved. And I was like, okay. But still, it's like, it's a lot of history. I don't, you know, I'm like, I don't even know where to start with this thing. So it started with us every Friday just having these Zoom calls, like not even just like talking. So Brian would kind of like talk about people or places in connection to the Shootin' Fest. And he would like name like rivers. And I'm like, oh, well, that's this river. It's located here, 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 boom, boom, boom. And he'll say something else, and I'll be like, oh, yeah, that is a school named after that guy. Man, I remember this one time when I was playing. So that's how the conversations went. And about 2 weeks into that, Mike Stein was like, okay, let's cut the shit. Jamal, you just need to tell your story as it relates to this. And I was like, okay. So I kind of sat with that, went home, had to go check on my mom, and got out with my boy KJ. Shout out to KJ. KJ's also nominated for a James Beard. He has a James Beard nomination. So every time I go home, I call up KJ. We go hang out. We go to bars or breweries or whatever. So we went to this brewery, and, you know, we're just talking, having a few pints. And he said it in jest, like, you know, just playing. He's like, dang, Jamal, where are the black people at? You know, laughing. You know, it didn't mean anything by it. And at that point, even though I've heard that so many times, I was like, I got it. Like, that's, yeah, that's my way into this thing. And so I came back, brought it to them, and was like, what do y'all think about this being like a kind of like a, like a kind of like what I explained before? Like, this is, beer is not a predetermination of who you are. Like, you come to it because you enjoy it. It has nothing to do about, you know, your gender, your race, your religion, like none of that stuff. Maybe sometimes religion, but like, you know, nobody's predetermined to not like or like beer. So that was kind of like my way in to the project.
That's really cool to hear, because I, reading it, I thought that maybe the, because especially with this very long, very dense historical, almost a research paper, really, it helps to have to start off with sort of real world, you know, personal context. So I wouldn't have been surprised if that in reality wasn't really that big of a moment. So it's really cool to hear how that unfolded organically. And that was sort of the thing that opened the floodgates of like, aha. Cause those, man, those moments are wild when it's like, ah, I got it now.
An actual spark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was laughing earlier, and I still am kind of chuckling, thinking about it, because historical, I mean, well, no, you really can't put the historical context aside, but just to think of post-Civil War era South Carolina having a beer and gun fest existing really at any time, but crazy to have it be this, I don't know, just I'm going to stop kind of explaining it, but it just seems like about the most unlikely thing possible.
Bruh, you are saying everything that I said to myself.
Uh-huh.
And then even prior to the Civil War, like, you have to think, South Carolina was the first state to secede from the Union. So, and a lot of those traditions, like a lot of folk in South Carolina, and specifically in Charleston, because Charleston is the beginning of the Civil War, like, people hold on to those traditions. Mm-hmm. And then, like how you said, like, you know, the Civil War is over, Reconstruction. And then at this point, you have people like Robert Smalls, who's African-American, like getting in these positions of like political power. So for a short amount of time, like, you know, it was very promising, you know. Mm-hmm. And not only that, you have a gun and beer festival going on in this place where African-Americans are drinking lager beer, not so much shooting guns. But like, just like heavily involved, like, it was crazy. And the craziest part is that the Southern whites didn't even consider the German immigrants as white, which is also crazy. Like, it's wild stuff going on.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because to me, I think that's a huge part of the story, is the evolution between the German immigrants at the time, mm-hmm, and Blacks at the time and how that played together. Can you kind of talk about that and its roots in the festival and kind of start moving that narrative forward?
Yeah. So, you know, you have German immigrants coming to South Carolina and newly freed African-Americans looking to be, you know, assimilated into American culture. And so everybody's kind of like trying to find their place at the time. And, you know, newly freed African-Americans, of course, you know, there's a little tension still going on there. And like I mentioned earlier, like the German immigrants weren't necessarily considered white by Southern whites. So that's kind of like, oh, you guys are outcasts or we're outcasts too. Let's kind of, I guess we have to kick it together. So the Germans had like these grocery stores. African-Americans would, you know, go there, support their businesses. A lot of times they would live together. They would intermarry. So it was like all this, you know, just intermingling going on. And then this festival comes about. And they, to my knowledge, they would have this festival, the Schützenfest, in a lot of different places. I know. So there's a town in South Carolina called Bamberg, which is like right outside of my the town where I went to college. And that, so that's like one of the moments during our research. I was like, yo, there's a town in South Carolina called Bamberg.
Yeah.
You know anything about beer, Bamberg, and then and all that
stuff? That's why it always smells smoky.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. But so they have, to this day, a Schützenfest in Bamberg still. So that was like one of the places, Bamberg and Aiken, South Carolina, they would have. But like in Charleston, I guess this was like the, you know, this was like the Vegas of Schützenfest in a sense. So anyway, like, you know, African-Americans began being involved in this fest as they would have like games there. Like I said, they weren't necessarily shooting the guns, but they were a lot of consumption of lager beer. They would they would be vendors. So they would sell sweeties and cookies and, you know, just like little snacks and lemonade. And we believe that they were may have been brewing persimmon beer. Never had persimmon beer before, but so that's going on. And then the Southern whites see this festival, guns, beer, African Americans, like, okay, yo, what's going on here? Nah, we need to get involved and see what's going on with this thing. So that happens, and, you know, the German immigrants looking for social acceptance, they, you know, obviously open their doors to the Southern whites, and Southern whites still don't want African Americans carrying the guns. So that's where the exclusion began. And exclusion began, went so far as to the point where it was basically illegal for African Americans to consume in public or to be perceived drunk, to the point where they would be flogged publicly or they would be put in jail. So that in itself, you know, and that from that point, tradition, generation on, people look at it like, well, if that's a sea of white folks, I'm not trying to go to jail. I'm not trying to be beaten just for having a good time drinking a beer. So I'm just going to go over here and do my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, in my opinion, and if anyone can prove me wrong, please do so. But I think that's the fingerprint specifically for Charleston, specifically for South Carolina, of the racial and gender exclusion from beer spaces. I think it's telling, man, like it's people learn things over time, over generations. And a lot of times people do things that they don't even really want to do. But it's like, hey, my grandmama did it. So now I'm doing it. And then you have to sit back and like, well, hold on. That shit really doesn't even make any sense to do it like that. But people just hold on to these traditions for whatever reason. And for me, I've never been the one to be like, oh, I can't go over there because nobody has tattoos, so I can't go. And I'm covered in tattoos. It's like, no, I'm going over there and I'm having a good time and I'm going to be my authentic self. And guarantee you, because it's never failed me before, I'm going to meet somebody before I leave. Be like, hey, man, let's get up. I'll call you. We can go hang out the next time. It's never failed. So, yeah.
And it's just one other quick thing. That's funny, because I was listening to this stand up, on my way up here yesterday. And just one of the jokes was basically kind of to speak to like the answer of like, well, going to breweries, white people's shit. He was saying he was skiing with his friend, and he asked his friend like, why is there no black people here? They're white. And then the white approach to that is to try to have all the answers to that, like in the ski chair. And the joke was the difference in that context. It's like, yeah, it's maybe it's not the true answer, but it's also totally okay to just be like, yeah, that's white people's shit. I don't know. So that's not really a question, just kind of a funny aside that it's just reading the article again last night. It was cracking me up thinking about that comparison, but.
And to keep it going on how beer in South Carolina became white people's shit, I want to keep kind of moving that forward. So to kind of summarize what you had just said, and tell me if I'm understanding it wrong from my reading of the article, is kind of the beginning of Schutz and Vess was very kind of amicable between the German immigrant whites, who really weren't accepted as Southern whites at the time, and blacks in the area. And as restructuring happens, but is also being rebelled against by the existing Southern whites, who don't want to see things change from a way that was a system that was very much benefiting them, this kind of slow progress for the German immigrants of becoming more and more accepted as white starts to grow. And as they become more accepted on that side, they start to adopt that white supremacy behavior and essentially become worse to the blacks in the area. Explaining a little bit of that, can you take us through the Schutz and Vess starting to really kind of evolve into a symbol of white supremacy, attracting local militia groups that really are functioning as kind of like offshoots of the KKK or arms of the KKK, or really...
Or overtly at certain
the
times.
KKK. Yeah. The KKK. But more than anything, representing whites who are kind of willing to fight for their racism, essentially, I think is the easiest way to put it. But kind of take us through some of that evolution, because to me, it's in that where we end up with a stat of zero brewery owners is coming from that long period of time of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit everything on the head. And here's the thing, like, we were only talking about beer. Let's be honest, beer is really not that serious. It's just this tangible 16 ounces of whatever. Like, it's really not that serious. But like, you know, you hear all this, you know, keep politics out of beer. This is a prime example where politics comes into beer. It's like if all this exclusion goes into just beer and beer making and beer drinking, imagine what it looks like into everything else. And like, yeah, like how you said, German immigrants looking for social acceptance. It just, at this point, it becomes a white nationalist organization because, you know, we're excluding these African-Americans and for even also to the conversation, women are really not a part of this whole thing, black, white at all. And then the use of guns and then military, and then you start getting some of the German immigrants getting into local politics and creating these, and I'm going to jump way, way, way ahead.
Sure.
What that looks like today. So back then they had like these, they started starting up these rifle clubs, and they were very like, you know, just like, yo, this is air quotes elite group, select group of folk. Everybody can't come in, but it kind of like championed, you know, the whiteness and white supremacy and keeping holding on to old traditions and all that stuff. This was back then. Charleston has the Charleston Rifle Club, right? The Charleston Rifle Club barred or did not accept an African-American. The one African-American that applied to join the Charleston Rifle Club, this was like maybe early 2010, something like that. And apparently like didn't give any real legit reason, whatever. Like the guy was like he was a damn surgeon, you know, like literally a surgeon. So, and it was like all this talk about this, like, oh, they're not accepting African-Americans. They've never had any African-Americans, because that Charleston Rifle Club is the same thing as that German Rifle Club. It just kind of like changed its name over time. Also, another key little thing. So where that Charleston Rifle Club is located in Charleston, that day when I went to that brewery and I was speaking with my friend and he says, oh, you know, there's no, black people around. That was KJ, by the way, who's also, again, nominated for a James Beard Award. But at that time, I didn't know any of this. We were on the actual grounds of where the Shoots and Fest took place.
Wow.
That brewery where we were was Edmund's Oast, which we mentioned in the piece about Edmund's Oast being named after Edmund Egan, who's considered the rebel brewer in Charleston. My team and I, Brian Hours, Mike Stein, Peter Carr Jones, we found out that Edmund Egan enslaved 8 African Americans to brew his beer. Edmund's Oast finds out or reads the piece or whatever, and we ended up, I don't know if you guys noticed, we did a beer collaboration. Hold that thought right there. But around the corner from Edmund's Oast is the Charleston Rifle Club. And the Charleston Rifle Club is on the banks of the Ashley River. So it makes sense as to where it's located and why Charleston was considered the largest Shoots and Fest, because it's right on the river. It's easy access for people to come in out of town. Boom, Charleston Rifle Club's right there. And like literally the grounds where we were is where the Shoots and Fest took place. About a half a mile going in the opposite direction, there's a Confederate memorial burial ground over there. So it's like, you know, I think I mentioned on the last podcast also, like, I'm not the biggest church going fella, but like this thing is, I think at this point, it's like bigger than me. Like, it's literally bigger than me. Like, this is some stuff that is like, I can't explain. That's kind of like, you know, now I'm getting emotional talking about this shit. But, like, all this stuff going on, man, like, it's good to see, man, and it's good to see, you know, people read it and have like a favorable response to it. You know, I'm not big on like bullying and stuff like that. And like, it was a time period, like, you know, I was helping fight bullies back in the day, you know, so I just never liked bullies. So it was like, even the thing with Edmund's Oast, like I was mentioning, like, their brewery's named after a guy named Edmund Egan, who was considered like the first brewery owner in Charleston, South Carolina, named the Rebel Brewer. They named their brewery after him because they kind of like championed him. You know, he's like, oh, you know, he's the first one in Charleston. And then, you know, we find information that, well, this guy had enslaved labor brewing his beer. 6 brewers and 2 coopers, and they were African-American. And in their marketing, they didn't lead with that. So, you know, for me, and it goes back to like, oh, well, that's some brewery, some white boy shit, and that's not for black people. It's like, well, we weren't told that we were there. You know what I'm saying? So that doesn't help the industry. It doesn't help the culture, because just think about if you have these West Africans bringing, you know, all this knowledge, because they were also fermenting persimmon beer. You got palm wine, like all this stuff. They have knowledge of fermentation. You have the German knowledge of fermentation. You know, it had all that stuff kind of come together. Who knows what Charleston could be the greatest beer city on the planet because of that. That's how I look at it, because mm-hmm. I like beer so much. Mm-hmm. And, so, like, you know, like putting little stuff like that in there, like, it wasn't necessarily to kind of like punch down on those guys, Edmund's Oast. It was kind of like, yo, this is an example. And, like, you know, so after that, I'm kind of like going way off now. they reach out to us, me and my team, Edmund Zosa, and we had these very awkward conversations for a little while. But we got to a point where it was like, all right, let's do something together.
Wow.
Let's do something. And so as beer people do, we brewed a beer. And that beer was called Eight and All. And damn, man. The beer was called Eight and All. And it was given life to the eight enslaved African Americans that brewed that beer back then, because we just still don't know their names. We didn't know their names. And it's kind of like a play off of words, Eight and All, where it looks like it's separated. It's these eight people and all of us. But essentially, I'm saying it's all of us. It's eight and all.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, yo, we're all a part of this thing. And again, like, it's just beer. It ain't that serious. But I think for everybody that's in the industry, it is serious. And I just think we can kind of like, this is going to sound real corny to say, but we can really change a lot of people's minds when it comes to shit. Like all this stuff about just inequality, gender, race, religion, guns, like all the stuff. I think, you know, sustainability, environmental justice, and like, yo, we can be the flagships to kind of like push these narratives, I think. And I think if we have everybody involved, it only benefits everybody.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I did not know about that depth of the Edmund Zosa stuff. Talk about we can move on from there completely. If you'd prefer, but the point you said about some really awkward conversations.
Hell yeah.
And then that leading to, I mean, it's not fucking corny if you're doing it, you know. There's a lot of things that are corny to be like, oh, let's change the world. But actually, if you're helping to change the world, it's no longer corny at all. And I mean, for how what came out of that situation with that beer seems like an amazing example of that. But still, the awkward conversations are always going to be what we want to try to avoid naturally. So if and I'm not at all trying to at all like disparage that. I really know nothing about that brewery. But yeah, how those conversations evolved and how they got to the place where they led to this beer.
And I just want to piggyback on that a tiny bit, because to me, hearing that, and there's a sense in your writing of this, but we can get to that later. But what's happening now with a lot of things is like when an opportunity like that presents itself, it's hate on the other side for that thing that doesn't allow for awkward conversation and understanding, and then collaboration is growth. It is the actionable way to get to better places. The unwillingness to have any understanding, or I guess to engage with that in any way, is what you also see a lot of right now and doesn't get to better places. So seeing that as an example is just so incredibly exciting. And like Noah said, it has to start with fucking these terrible conversations that most people move away from, because everybody's kind of taking the path of less resistance. And if we do that, nothing ever changes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, it was just like, you know, it's like poker faces. So we, I think it was Timmons works for Edmund Zost. And I think he like sent me an email. Was like, oh, you know, great pieces. You know, my team and I would love to like speak with you in regards to the Edmund Zost content. I'm like, you know, this is how I'm thinking. I'm not thinking about going to blows with anybody, but in my mind, I'm like, I never ran from no fight. So, okay. Like, you know, we could talk about it. But so it was like, it was awkward in a sense because, you know, my guys are sitting, everybody's poker faced up. So everybody, you know, they're kind of like talking and then, you know, they're explaining, you know, that the things that they've done in the past and, you know, what they're doing. And, they admitted that, you know, at some point they felt like this store, this name is kind of going to be brought up. And I think that they were like trying to, and they were a bit shout out to Edmund Zos, man, because like they really also, man, like they were open.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. There was not like not any pushback or like they were very open, man, and like always gracious to them, man. But it's like they were honest in the fact that they were like, yo, you know, we're trying to learn what this means. We're trying to understand that. Damn, that isn't cool. And like on their website, like they had a lot of you know, wordage about who Edmund Egan was and Rebel Brew and all of that stuff have since been removed. Mm. So like I said, it was like a conversation and a half where it was kind of like stone face, and then like I said, it got to a point where it was like, yo, let's collaborate, let's do something. And you know, it's so if I can talk about the beer a little bit, like again, like the beer is called Eatonol, and so it was American Strong Ale. So I think I mentioned last podcast, like I'm a huge fan of like quads and all of that. Granted, American Strong Ale is not a quad, but kind of closely related a little bit, maybe a little bit higher on the bitterness. But I was looking at the cuisine back home. So the cuisine back home is a lot of seafood, a lot of rice, like a lot of soup, like hearty ass dishes. And they have a tendency to be a little bit spicy. So something like American Strong Ale, I thought, you know, it would like pair really well with it. Like you have a lot of dishes, you have meat, you know, cooked or smoked for an extended period of time. So it's a great complement to it. And the image on the can was done by one of my college buddies, Damian Johnson. It's an image of an enslaved African American with a torture mechanism. It's called a collar. So it's like basically like a metal dog collar around his neck, and it has like these spikes coming off of it. And so this was torture because they would put these on enslaved individuals if they were deemed insubordinate, whatever that means, right? And that prevented them from laying down, sleeping. You got this big collar around your neck. It's chafing. It's humidity. Bug is getting infected. Like, it's just, it's wild, right? So it's that picture on there facing one way, and at the bottom it's the same picture facing the other way. You got very aggressive, like, whoo type image, because I wanted it to be more of an art piece as opposed to just something that you drink. It's very easy to just drink the beer that was in that can. It's so easy. It's not that hard. It's very hard or difficult or can be awkward to have the conversation. And so that's what that was, because I wanted it to for people to see it and be like, even for black folks, be like, yo, are you drinking a slave? Yo, what is that? And then even for other people who are aware of what that image is, like, ooh, I don't feel comfortable drinking that. You know what I'm saying? I think that's going to, you know, it's art. It's supposed to evoke emotion.
Mm.
And then also like little details that had Adinkra symbols on it, which are West African symbols. And what that symbol means is that it's important to know your past to understand where you're going. Hence why one picture of the enslaved guy is looking one way, the other guy's looking back. So it's kind of like, yo, I know this history is crazy. I know it's wild. I know if you're a white guy and you hear all this talk about, oh, you know, white guys, it is white people do that. I get it. I know if you're African American, it's like, yo, another slave movie? I don't want to get it. It's like, I get all of that. But understand why it is important of knowing that stuff. If we know that going forward, it's going to be 10 times easier. This shit is crazy now, I think. The world is pretty trash right now. But I think it's 10 times better than it was in the 50s, in the 20s. Mm. It's a lot better. It ain't perfect, but it's a lot better. Because the fact that we can have this conversation and I can, like, honestly give you my viewpoint on this thing and not worry about getting lynched and all of that stuff, like... Yeah, that's the eerily. That's kind of like some progress on my regard.
It's wild.
Not that long ago. It's fucking when I remember the context of the relative recency.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And so you have to understand that, like, a lot of again, a lot of traditions are still being held because that shit is not that long ago. If you go back into your family, that's like two people. That's like two grandparents. It's not that far.
Right.
Anyway, there's a couple stats that always jump out at me. There's one in your piece. I think you kind of referenced it before, but that like the Charleston Rifle Club, the first black member that was admitted, 2020, 2 years ago. And I always get this. I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but not by much. I love the game of golf. And again, it's very easy to just play golf and not think about much about it. But if you spend a little time and dive into golf a little bit, holy fuck.
Yeah.
And even like Augusta National, where the Masters is held, all this incredible. And it's very, it ties to this conversation because of geography and where it is and all of that. I believe the year that they accepted their first black member, 1996.
Mm. Yep.
I mean, it's so fucking recent. It's unbelievable to think about 1996. What these things weren't that long ago. But just to piggyback on where we were going a little bit, because I can't get past the example that that is to take this – take this negative, have a teachable moment, be willing to collaborate. And we're in this weird place now, like you say, the world is crazy with so much division that I find myself thinking a lot about tearing the statues down and this type of stuff. It's become so divisive. And I do think there's some points on either side. One of them is just clouded in racism, like don't touch our statues, whatever, whatever. I can't get to that side. But I do think you're doing a major disservice if when you just try to tear them down, you meet hate with hate and you lose the opportunity to do what you've just shown an example of, which is use that negative as a teachable moment. Like this statue is here. We've been taught one thing in history about who this man was or woman was. Generally, it's a man. Mm-hmm. Let me educate you on what this man actually did and often owned slaves and this and that and how he perpetuated a system that allowed him to reign supreme. I just think there's so much to be said for taking that path of using those transgressions with empathy to educate. And that looks like exactly what you did with this collaboration. And I guess all I'm saying is I'd love to see more of that in a world of division. I don't really know what to do with that.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering how you think about those big divisive talk.
It's
go ahead.
No, not to cut you off, my man, but like,
no, my man.
It's, you know, I try to look at everybody's side, regardless of how dark it may be. So, you know, I have like somewhat of a teaching foundation. So, and I like learning new things. I think, so like, let's talk about the statue. So in Charleston, you have the John C. Calhoun statue. There's no like tall skyscrapers in Charleston. Like you can't have any building higher than a church steeple. Well, that's why they call it the Holy City. But this John C. Calhoun statue towers above everything. Coming into the city, you can see this thing. And there's a street named after him. And like, you know, he's a prominent figure, air quotes, I don't know, prominent figure in American history. He also owned tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of enslaved labor. So they tore that statue down. That statue's been up for as long as I think even before I was born. But I think the crazy part of these statues is that I don't think that statue was erected during his lifetime or during the Civil War. Like it was erected fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times those statues are put there to, I can only speak for Charleston.
Totally.
Let folks know, hey, this is still how it is. Don't get no fucking ideas. I don't need y'all writing no paid no pieces for no beer publications. No, no, no. Y'all not doing any of this. This is to let you know that it's not going to change. So I think you have to look at that.
Sure.
So also, I think you have to look at the fact that, yo, this man was a, what he was a, did like a lot of politics and stuff. So I think there is some preservation that should be had there. Does that statue need to tower above the city at the point where whenever it was erected, the Charleston was probably about 70 to 85% African American. I don't think so. Should that be in a museum to be like, yo, this is a statue that was up in 1968. It was taken down at blah, blah, blah. Here's why. Here's John C. Calhoun. Here's why people felt that it should be taken. Like, all of that needs to be told, like the whole gamut. So, like, yeah, like, I mean, I think that the removal of the statue is – I go back and forth. I think the removal of statues are like, I think it's a quick fix. And yeah, to echo what you said, like, yeah, I just think it's like a ripping the Band-Aid off or kicking an ant pile over without giving any context as to why. And like, you know, people consider that Confederate flag as heritage. Well, I don't think it should be flying on the state capitol, but there should be a level of preservation there because that is an actual event that happened and this represented a certain part of, you know, I can't say the U.S. or the secession or whatever. So, like, you know, it should be preserved. It should be talked about. How specifically you do that, I don't know, man, because you're dealing with generations of traditions, whether they be false or whatever. So you kind of have to like break down that. The work that we're doing now is not for us. It's for our great grandkids. So we just have to keep that in mind, man, because once they get our age, hopefully a lot of these talks, you know, won't be as met with so much hate. Like actually just talk about it.
And to, I want to kind of parlay that and play devil's advocate on the own thing I said, because I do see the importance, the symbolic importance in getting rid of that. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is you kind of close out the piece with what I thought was just like tactically so smart and so well done, and it stayed with me and kept me thinking. And you talk about the persimmon beer that you'd mentioned here for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you reference food historian Michael Twitty, who has written about this persimmon beer that his ancestors made to toast the end of slavery in 1865. But of course, the future of American brewing was fizzy, yellow, German, and increasingly white. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that thing that as that happened, and that you almost, as you started getting into the emotional place, you were almost imagining this perfect ideal of where there had been collaboration between the persimmon beer and the German, and there was love and collaboration, and this new form of brewing was born, and it was inclusive of everybody. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't. It was white and pale. And frankly, I think I got a little bit inspired by your good writing, because in my notes, as I was doing this, I said something about that beer in America became as pale and light as the people that were drinking it. And I was pretty proud of that. But anyways, but talk about that. To me, that was kind of that finishing punch that draws the whole thing like together of they went on to write their own history and dictate American beer culture. And still this many years later, we don't have a black owned brewery in this state.
Yeah. So we technically do. So there's a contract brewer, a young lady, and it's crazy because she's a woman named April Dove. She has this beer called the Community Beer. And she started off with a pale lager. And so, again, like she's contract brewing, so she links up with different breweries in the city, Holy City, Frothy Beard, and like she's doing like all this really, really cool stuff. So shout out to April Dove. But like, yeah, I think it was just a missed opportunity, man. Like I just, you know, I know a lot of brewers, man, down in D.C. and up in here. Like, you know, brewers are fucking nerds, man. Brewers are nerds, and like the ones that I know, they're like always looking for some, oh yeah, I put 5% of it. Like they really, you know, they love it. And I just think like, yo, with all of this fascination that my boys have, some of my brewery homies have with like just different ingredients and different stone fruits and all that, like imagine like if that was in Charleston, all of that West African sorghum could always been a thing. You got persimmon. There's even been mentionings of sassafras beer. Like all this stuff, man. Like even so, I think it was my boy Kofi, who owns Sankofa Brewing Company out in D.C. I think they were using, it's like a starch, yucca in like their mash or whatever.
Oh, damn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So like that's like some, you know, West African stuff right there. Like that's the stuff that I'm talking about. Like, you know, it's just, I just think it was a missed opportunity, man. Like it could have been so, it could have been like, yo, y'all need to come to Charleston because they have this red rice lager with blah, 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 blah. And like, it could have just been a thing. You know what I'm saying? So
do you say missed opportunity, like the door is closed. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way?
Now, so I don't live in Charleston, so I can't really speak to, I know a lot of good folk in Charleston, Pierce Fleming, who owns Common House L Works, and a guy I just met, JT Stalmack over at Holy City. Like, you know, they're really inviting, and I haven't been to all the breweries in Charleston, but like those two, you know, they're really like inviting to like bringing people in and like just kind of like trying to do like really, really cool stuff. I don't think the door is closed. I just think, I think the house is new in Charleston. Because it's like, again, like it's Charleston holds on to a lot of traditions, man, and it's just embedded into the culture. And I think it's just that stereotypical perception of how the South is, like a lot of that, yeah, it's true in Charleston. A lot of that, yeah, it's slow in a lot of regard. But I do see some. I see, if we're just talking about Gullah Geechee culture, I'm beginning to see a lot of that now coming in. And I don't want to be arrogant and say that it was because of the peace. I definitely think the peace helped. But I think there were also people before me, April Dove, they're doing some stuff. There's a really popular chef in Charleston named BJ Dennis. He did a collaboration beer with a brewery called Revelry in Charleston. It was, I think it was like a rice lager and I don't know if they use Carolina gold rice, but, you know, rice is a main staple in Charleston. So it only makes sense that, yo, make a rice lager of some sort. So I think the house is new. So I think, you know, we're starting to kind of like creep that door open to kind of like bring in all the influences. So.
Mm. Mm. Well, we've taken up plenty of your time. Is there anything to close off? Are you working on anything else? What's kind of next? Or are you just sort of waiting for that to come to you again, like it has?
Yeah. So, with the piece also, so we had a, we had a festival.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Take Care of the Root Festival, which was held at my boy Pierce Fleming's brewery, Common House L Works. And that was like that was basically me on the panel moderated by KJ and these two young ladies called a cocktail band. It's like they're heavy on the spirits and stuff. And it was a conversation about disparities and inclusion and diversity and in the beer and wine, beer and spirits industries or whatever. So, you know, that was good. Spoke with Pierce a few months after that, you know, just to kind of like talk about how that went. And he asked if I wanted to do it again. I was like, yeah, but, you know, I don't know if I want to do it like that one. I've been having this idea about water in my mind. At the time, I didn't know where to go with it. And he was like, okay, well, you know, once you get something together, you know, let's talk again. So anyway, my boy Mike Stein, which worked with me on this project, he and I are working on a project. I don't want to give too much of it away, but it's about water. It's about floods, oysters, and beer, and like environmental justice. And trust me, the gap, like we were struggling trying to how to close that gap, how to connect all of those, and we found it.
Oh, damn.
It's so wild. I'm not telling you what it is at all.
Come on.
Like, yeah, we're like interviewing folk and like really getting some research down. But like this is the stuff that I love talking about, man, because it's taking that one tangible thing that we love, but it's like it's connecting and showing the impact that it can have on our communities. It's all this talk about community in our industry. And like, this is like, I don't want to say this is the one, but like this is going to help to amplify that conversation.
Damn, man. Did I see right that you're moderating at a panel in DC next weekend?
Yeah.
On the complexity of innovation.
Yeah. So there's a Savor DC is happening in a couple of weeks. If you know anything about Savor, it's held by the Brewers Association. I think it's like 150 breweries there from all over the country. And it's like a food pairing thing. And this is like my third or fourth time going. It's awesome. But the night before, I'm moderating a panel at the Heyrich House Museum about the complexity of innovation. So contract brewing represents, 1% of all craft breweries in the U.S.? And in D.C., D.C. has more black-owned breweries per capita than any city in the country. Mm. All of those breweries are contract brewers. So I think there's a conversation that needs to be had as to why that is. And it's kind of crazy because I don't know about all of them, but I do know a few of them, like they prefer to only do, like they don't want a brick and mortar. They want to only contract brew. But there's like some really good reasons behind that. So it's not so much as like contract brewing is kind of like the bad word. It's kind of like it's more of like an innovation kind of thing that they're doing and providing like another, basically an alternative business model to making beer. So, yeah, it should be cool. So the breweries that are on the panel are Soul Mega, Sankofa, and Urban Garden. And there's going to be a young lady there from Black Beer Movement who is basically – it's a craft beer platform to kind of like bring more diversity and inclusion into the beer scene. So yeah, that should be cool, man.
Incredible.
Awesome, man.
As we wind it down and get into a man who knows and has some experience doing the three bay, I did just want to end a little bit lightly and kind of ask you personally, and I guess I got a funny segue to do it, but I noticed on your Instagram a little ways back, you posted these Crocs. First of all, they're beautiful, incredible colorway.
Yeah.
And I know this because I own that same colorway of the Crocs. But you had a book next to it called The Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter. I'm familiar with the book, haven't read it, but the idea in it is something I've been thinking about a lot. And just as somebody who's obviously a very deep thinker, you've written some of these incredible pieces. You really look at things and analyze them well. I just wanted to kind of close it with what have you been thinking about and interested in kind of personally in a self, like self-improvement kind of space? What have you been, what's been taking up your bandwidth when it comes to improving yourself and how you want to be in the world?
Yeah. So I'll be honest, my man, like I don't even think of myself. I'm married and I have a 4-year-old.
Oh.
Everything I do, this, you hear people say this all the time. And it's crazy because when I would hear people say that, I used to be like, man, that's some bullshit. What does that even mean? Like, I do it for them. So for my son, that the comfort crisis, shout out to Michael Easter, man. Michael Easter is the GOAT, man. Like, that book basically tells you why you should always do hard shit all the time. Like, okay, we're just thinking about working out. Like, so I do CrossFit 3-4 days a week. And every day I go, I get my ass kicked. Like, it's, you know, there's never a day that I walk out of there. It's like, yeah, I did it. I won the day. It's like, no. Like, after every workout, I'm falling over, breathing, panting hard, all that stuff, right? But that stuff is good for the mind more so than the body because it gets the mind used to, oh, I have a task in front of me. I need to get through this task. And I can't just stop. I can't just walk out the gym. You just got to keep going and you're going to get tired, but you got to keep going. And for him, for my son, I'm always putting him in little situations where he has to do things for himself and he'll get frustrated. He may throw a tantrum and like, I just try to, I don't want to say it's tough love, but it's like my thing now is like, yo, work your way through it. What's going on? Why are you frustrated? Okay, so how are we going to work through this thing? So if I'm used to doing that, it's going to be a great model for him to continue to used to do that. And also on the health side, like I want to be here for a little bit. You know, I don't want to be the lazy dad. My son is highly, highly active, never doesn't take naps, always running. And I want to be able to keep up with him, you know, which I've been able to do. So everything that I'm doing is like really for them, even with the beer stuff, man. Like, so I homebrew and I just want him to see it. And I know like a lot of old timers may be like, you drinking beer in front of that boy and making beer. It's like, yo, it's not. Yes, it's a, yes, I'm doing all of that. But it's also showing him that when he gets older, or even now, he says, well, my daddy makes beer. And people may think that, well, you don't make beer. Yeah, my daddy makes beer in the kitchen. And he's going to grow up knowing that, oh, yeah, well, my dad used to make beer. So then that's going to turn into, at some point, I'm going to be able to tell him, look, man, you can learn everything you want to learn. Like, okay, you want to go to school, be a mathematician, or if you want to be a teacher, cool. You need to learn how to do something with your hands. If you want to go and work in retail, cool, honest job. If that company tanks and now you don't have a job, where at least I have a foundation of how to make beer that I can probably still earn a living in some kind of capacity.
Yeah.
It has to be beer, but you need to learn some kind of trade or something to where that you can put it to good use, even if you know you don't necessarily want to. So. I'm just trying to get better like y'all, man. That's all, you know.
I love it, man.
Yeah.
I have a lot more to say, but I guess we'll just have to do this a third time. I can't remember what we did for Three Bay the first time, but we'll keep it into real light zone here after we've naturally talked about some extremely heavy stuff
totally.
This conversation. So we've not really mentioned football at all, which I know is probably like eating you up inside just a tiny bit. So I'm going to give you three Clemson greats. That's your team, right?
Ooh, yes.
Okay.
Come on with it, baby.
Okay. And then as a certified Cicerone, match up however you want each of these guys with a style of beer. Mm. Any type. So let's go. DeAndre Hopkins has been a saving grace for my fantasy team multiple years in a row.
I've seen it in action. It's true. Yep.
Let's go Brian Dawkins, probably the best defensive player to ever play at Clemson. And let's go with Trevor Lawrence.
Okay.
One of the best quarterbacks Clemson's ever had. Who knows how it's going to go in the NFL still. And then I'll leave the beer styles up to you.
All right. So DeAndre Hopkins, I'm just going to go with, I'm just going to go like a German lager or like a Czech pills. Like that is DeAndre Hopkins. Just, I can burn you down the field. I'm going to catch every ball. I'm impeccable route runner. I'm tough. I'm athletic. Like, it's just, it's kind of everything. It's just, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm. It's getting it done.
That pills or that German lager is perfect. Like, you can't have any flaws in that thing. Like, it's just perfect, perfectly carbonated. It's clear. It's crisp. Like, it can kind of go with, like, a lot of dishes. DeAndre Hopkins. Brian Dawkins. Most definitely a Belgian quad because he is plus you over the head. He did it at Clemson. He did it in Philly with the Eagles. He could probably still do it now, even though he's retired. Belgian quad. And Trevor Lawrence, I'm going to say Saison. I'm going to say Saison.
You don't know which way it's going.
You know, because the packaging was perfect. You know what I'm saying? He's 6'6". He's got an arm. He's smart. He showed it. His career at Clemson was the packaging. Like, it, yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's just, it's got the cork in there and it's got the dark bottle, the nice label. You can cellar it if you want. You know what I'm saying?
How long he's going to be in the cellar, I don't know.
How long? You know? How long? So it's just a matter of, is this like too funky of a beer or is it just right? You know, that's what Trevor Lawrence is, man.
I love it, man.
Incredible.
Wow, that was fucking amazing and very surgically precise.
Incredible.
Well, Jamal, Thank you so much for doing this, man. It's just like last time. It is a certain type of feeling talking to you.
100%.
And it has been very, very beneficial for me to kind of sit with and the things that opens up going forward. So just in short, from one random ass dude, keep fucking doing what you're doing, man. Especially having talked to you a year later now, it's just like your trajectory has remained exactly the same. And it's just fucking from afar. It's very, very, very inspiring to see, man.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it, man. And like, you know, so I'm leaving out tomorrow to go to Chicago for this award show for James Beard. And like, you know, this is going to be, if we win, when we win, it's a win for us.
Baby.
I mean, the industry, man, the beer folk, because, you know, it's not a lot of beer folk nominated for these awards. It's like us, it's two from GBH, me and my team, Teresa McCullough, and it's like another piece and under the media awards that's nominated. So essentially, we have to come to the party and fight everybody. So I think this is a good opportunity, you know, when we win to kind of like, you know, we all hold beer to a certain prestige, and it'll be good for other folk to see and witness that same prestige that we hold. And so, like, when we win, it's going to be a win for all of us, man. So we're planning on bringing back the hardware. I'll say that.
Oh, I can tell. Yeah. I can tell. Yeah. And I'm planning on it too, man. Well, best of luck. And either way, at the end of the day, like, what you've done is a lot more, a lot more than hardware anyway, at this point. Yeah. That is just packaging, as you say, at the end of the day. So however that goes, it's just keep it fucking up, man. Amazing. But for real, great luck at that. I can only imagine the nerves at something like that.
And so much more to do. Keep staying uncomfortable. You're such an easy guy to root for. And thank you for being so generous with your time. And fuck you for not telling us more about the water and the oysters. I'll be looking out for that, my friend.
Hell no. Y'all had me on here crying, man. I ain't crying in almost 27 years, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. You were very generous with your time and your emotions.
Thank y'all, man. I appreciate it.
We both cried many times on this, so you're in good company.
Yeah.
That's two cries in a row, I think, for Matthew Parks. That's incredible work, and we got one.
We've shed many waterworks, the Certainly. Two of us, so back you're in good back. Company. You're in good company.
Appreciate it, man. I'll hit you with a follow-up email. Grab some of the final stuff to put this out, and good luck. I'm in the mood.